Hey, my name's Otis Gray, host of the Daily Book Club, a daily podcast where I read wonderful old books one chapter at a time. Simple as that. Whether you want to get engaged and lost in a fascinating story that has stood the test of time, or just relax to a good book, listen to the Daily Book Club to get wrapped up or unwind during your day. We'll read classic stories like Pride and Prejudice, The Enchanted April, The Wind in the Willows, beautiful stories all told from start to finish. And you can even do a real book club. Tune into the Daily Book Club Discord and discuss the readings with other book club listeners. However you want to listen, it's your choice. Subscribe to the Daily Book Club on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else. New episodes every single day. So sit back, relax, and get lost in the Daily Book Club.
Amateur Traveler, episode 273. Today, the Amateur Traveler goes to a place once called the Paris of the Middle East as we travel to Lebanon. Welcome to the Amateur Traveler. I'm your host, Chris Christensen. Before we get into today's interview, I do have three news stories for you. First one, two men tried to reenact snakes on a plane by trying to bring 40 pythons on board an Indonesia flight to Dubai. Seems to me to be a bad idea. It wasn't snakes, but rather caterpillars that grounded a small plane in Australia because larvae got inside of some of the sensitive instruments. But even that is not as scary as in India, where they're having a problem with fake pilots. Ever since a female captain, subsequently found to have faked her qualifications, landed a packed airliner on the nose instead of the rear wheels as she touched down in Goa, at least five other pilots working for Indian Airlines had been arrested for having bogus licenses. I'm thinking you may want to check that. For links to all of those stories, check out the show notes at amateurtraveler.com. I'd like to welcome back to the show Sherry Ott, who is coming to us from Ott's World, currently sitting on a beach in Sri Lanka, but come to talk to us about Lebanon. Sherry, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
And Sherry, again, is one of those bloggers on my short list of friends who I've enjoyed meeting through this podcast. Sherry, what led you to Lebanon and Beirut? Have you not been following the news this year? Don't you know that the entire Middle East is someplace you shouldn't go? Do I sound like your mother?
Yes, actually. Well, strangely, this is the weird fact that when I happened to be in Lebanon, which was the month of February, it was really one of the only countries in the Middle East that had nothing going on as far as unrest. And so it's really strange, considering Lebanon's history, for it to be the safe place to be. And in fact, many of the locals that I hung out with and talked to found it all rather kind of ironic. And they were very proud of the fact that Lebanon was the one stable place, it seemed like. So it was very safe there. And quite frankly, I had just spent the previous month in January in Jordan. And Jordan was also very safe, yet happened to be when I left Jordan that same day, they had some issues. But nothing major. So where I was in the Middle East, it seemed very safe. It was very interesting to watch what was going on in the Middle East from so close and to be able to talk to people in the Arabic world and really get their thoughts on it. And so it was actually a great vantage point, if you'd ask me.
Excellent. So what led you to Lebanon and why should people follow in your footsteps?
Well, very honestly, what led me to Lebanon were two things. One, I've done a lot of travel, but I really wanted to get deeper into the Middle East culture and the Arabic culture. And so I decided to spend my winter in the Middle East, Jordan and Lebanon. But that was also really the second reason is it was really facilitated by a company that I've worked with in the past on some of my other projects and sites, a company called GeoVisions. And they're actually a volunteer company from America that wanted me to just go and check out their volunteer programs that they have going on in the Middle East. So I actually participated in their programs And I allowed them to say, you know, where do you want to send me? And they chose Lebanon and they chose Jordan. And that's how I ended up there, quite frankly.
Can you tell us something about the nature of the programs that you were involved in?
Sure. Volunteering is probably maybe not the correct word exactly for what I was doing. They are a volunteer organization and they have typical volunteer projects. But what I was doing was they had a program called Conversation Corps, which is basically, I look at it as a cultural exchange. You live with a family for a minimum of 1 month, kind of like a student exchange in a way. But you live with that family, they put you up room and board, and you tutor them in English for a couple hours a day. But the families I lived with, and especially the one in Lebanon, it was very, very loose. The tutoring was really just like, make sure that you're having conversations on a daily basis, which of course you have to do. So it was just a really great way to dig deep into the culture and really feel like you live in a place as opposed to touring through a place. So that was the nature of the program.
And this is something that they do with other travelers as well.
Oh, yeah. I mean, obviously, it's a business. They have these conversation corps all over the world in various countries. And it's a really unique kind of different take on volunteering, but just a really cool way for someone like myself that really likes to dig deep culturally into a country to get involved. And for me, it was fairly economical. I mean, the cost isn't that out of the ordinary. And like I said, it picked up my room and board, which is great.
And now that you've been to Lebanon, as we hear the sounds of Sri Lanka in the background here.
Oh, sorry.
What surprised you?
The best way I can answer that is say the contrast. So quite frankly, I'd been to India before and everyone talks about how it's a land of contrasts. But when I got to Lebanon, I found it to even be more so than India, this whole contrasting thing. It has a little bit of everything. It was big city, but also you could get really deep into like small villages. But the big city was very urban, you know, kind of like New York City in a way. It had a nightlife. It was lots of variety, shopping, very modern.
And when we say the big city, we're talking about Beirut.
Beirut, yes.
Formerly known as the Paris of the Middle East. Don't I have that right?
Yeah. Absolutely right. And yes, you can see a lot of French architecture there too, quite frankly. But the other things about the contrasts, I mean, so you have city and country, you have like beach and mountains. The Lebanese are very proud of the fact that they can say, like in the month of March or April, you can actually go skiing in the morning and then drive to the beach in the afternoon and hang out. And that's very true. I mean, probably one of the few countries I've been to that you can do that. So you've got a lot of variety in that sense. But I think the other reason that you should go to Lebanon is if you're really interested in, like, honestly, the Middle East culture and actually history, I would say. There's so much. What I ended up most fascinated by about Lebanon was the war history, the very, very recent war history, really. And so you can really start to learn about some of the challenges of living in the Middle East. And that was the thing probably that fascinated me the most. And I learned a lot.
And when you say the war history, the Civil War primarily?
Yes, the Civil War. I mean, that went on for like 15 years. But quite frankly, even the more recent issues that they had back in 2005, which then kicked off a whole bunch of bombing again in 2005, 2006. I think they also had some in 2008.
With the Israeli invasion.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. And it's just the one thing you'll notice when you go there, everywhere you go in Lebanon, there are reminders of that. And I think the interesting thing that I find is that the locals, they're so used to living with it, and it's so much part of their culture and lives and everyday life that they don't even really notice it too much anymore. But as an outsider, when you come in, it was the first thing that stuck out to me. So whether it be like pictures of martyrs that were assassinated up all over the buildings, bullet holes riddling all the buildings that hadn't been refurbished yet, I mean, it was just really interesting contrast. So that's what I mean also by, you know, why should someone go if you really want to see the contrast, and especially the effects of recent and very prolonged unrest and war, Lebanon is the place to go.
If I go to Lebanon, if I go to Beirut, when you say that's the thing to see, is there particular spots I should go to? If we want to give people an itinerary of what they should see, let's say starting in Beirut, what would you recommend?
You know, my favorite thing to do in Beirut, I mean, I'm assuming you're just talking in general, not necessarily
sure.
with the war. Okay. My favorite thing to do in Beirut was really to simply walk around. I mean, I think, you know, I'm a photographer too. So my favorite thing is to go into a neighborhood and just walk with my camera. But there are certainly some organized tours that I went on actually that were really interesting. There's one called Walk Beirut that will also walk you around the city and give you all the history, a lot of history about the unrest there and the war. But as far as places to see, I would kind of attack Beirut in kind of a neighborhood fashion. If you have multiple days, hopefully, you know, you can go and walk around the neighborhood of Jemaise, which is, you'll see a lot of old French architecture there, with some really run-down buildings, but also some that have been restored a little bit. It's a really cool kind of neighborhood feeling. You'll run into guys playing backgammon out on the streets. You know, everyone's just really, really friendly. Then I would say the downtown area is fascinating to walk through. The downtown area is the one that's really was the heart of the war, quite frankly, of all the fighting. And it was where you see everything was pretty much leveled in downtown back in the Civil War. So they've done a really good job of rebuilding. But it also creates this, it's all very new. Everything is very new. But then you'll get these little old demolished, still war-torn buildings thrown in that they haven't had time to restore yet. So that I find very interesting. There's a huge mosque downtown that's worth seeing where the prime minister that was assassinated was buried near there, Hariri. And then, you know, amidst the mosques, right next door are the Christian churches. So you get this real feeling everywhere you go, actually, this mix. But downtown especially, because everything is like within the same block, you'll have a mosque and a church. And then another great area to walk through is Hamra. Hamra is what I would call probably the more bohemian area. It's very funky. There's the reason why I liked it, I think, also is that's where the American University is, AUB, American University of Beirut. So it kind of has this kind of like college campus feel in a way. Lots of cute little bars and pubs and tattoo parlors and things that you would normally find around a college campus.
And, you know, I haven't heard much about the American University of Beirut in some time. I honestly didn't know that it was still operating in amidst all of the unrest that has happened in that country.
Yeah. I wasn't able to go onto campus, but the campus, from what I've seen, is beautiful. It also kind of bumps up. It starts in kind of in the Hamra area, so like this kind of funky campus-like town area, and then it actually spills out onto the corniche or the beach area. So it covers a big span, the campus, and it's very, very nice. There's a hospital there, too, and yeah, I really liked it. That whole area I thought was really interesting. And then I referenced the corniche, which is the kind of beach walkway, I would say. So it just this beautiful, big, open sidewalk where you can just walk the coastline, basically, all through Beirut for the most part. There you'll find kind of the famous Pigeon Rock, which is a couple of rocks, neat rock formations on the Mediterranean. But it's also just quite fascinating because, once again, there's a lot of history around there. That's where a lot of the fighting happened. So that area is all full of brand new, like, condo high-rises and some fancy hotels and stuff like that. So, you know, I think going through the neighborhoods, you know, taking a day, if you can, for each neighborhood or something like that is something I would recommend. There is a museum there that's supposed to be really great. I will say I did not get to it, but you could also do a day there, I'm sure, or a half day there. So that's what I would probably recommend for Beirut as far as like what can you do, what can you see. But I really, really encourage if you do go that you hopefully sit down, find some locals and talk to them. Talk to them about politics, about the history and so on. I mean, you'll learn so much. That's what I found the most rewarding.
And is there any scene that is the easiest to approach locals? I know in some Muslim countries, it's the tea bar or someplace like that. I don't know what it would be in Beirut.
I suppose, you know, any kind of bar where you can smoke shisha, which is pretty much everywhere, the little water, well, not little, but the large water pipes where they smoke the sweet tobacco.
Right.
That's prevalent everywhere.
So that's the same as the hookah or the nargala.
Yes. Or, yeah, there's like a ton of names for it. Hubbly bubbly, shisha.
Right.
Yeah. But yeah, I think anytime you can sit down with a local and and talk to them there, you'll get an earful, no doubt. But, you know, I even, as I walked around with my camera, everyone's so friendly. I ended up sitting down and watching these guys play backgammon for probably a good 40 minutes and talking to them. Just old guys that had been there, you know, lived there forever, lived through the war. So I think if you stray a little bit out of the more touristy areas, so I'm going to say out of downtown a little bit and into these other kind of just regular neighborhoods, you're going to find that people are really open. You can go sit down at any little coffee shop or even, you know, guys playing backgammon and sit and talk to them.
And speaking of locals, who left the biggest impression on you that you met there?
You know what? I'm going to say there was a woman I met. Her name was Yola. And she was actually the office manager for GeoVisions in Beirut. So I spent a lot of time with her. But the reason why I say she was the most interesting or fascinating is we were driving together. She was driving me to a town called Tanayel. We were going to this volunteer opportunity to go review it. And it was a drive out of Beirut over the mountains. And it was fascinating because, you know, we were talking the whole time. And she grew up in Beirut, obviously. And I started asking her, she was married and had children. What did her family do during the Civil War? Like, what happened? And her family, like many others, left the country during that time. And so she was telling me this story of, you know, them going to Canada, and they lived in Canada for a few years. And then they decided they wanted to come back and the war wasn't over. And so I think what surprised me the most, you know, we were just talking and driving and talking and driving. And then she said something about, you know, actually, I think it was February 9th, she said, this is the anniversary of when my husband was shot. And I'm like, really? So that kind of surprised me. But he was actually shot during the war. He was a civilian who was delivering groceries to, he supplied kind of wholesale groceries to grocery stores. And he was driving a minivan and they mistook him for militia and shot him in the lung. Or he was shot in the lung, and today he lives with one lung yet. But I mean, just the way that she mentioned it and how it was so nonchalant, like, oh, you know, and it, of course, stunned me because I don't meet people like that often. The other thing interesting is we went driving around her old neighborhood, which was like literally a half a block from the Green Line, which is where a bunch of the fighting happened in Beirut. And I'll have to give you the picture of her building that she grew up in, her childhood home. I mean, it's completely bombed out, the floor that they lived on. So, I mean, you know, we went around and I think she was so fascinating to me because, like I said, it just all seemed, it's such a part of their lives. And she was so nonchalant about it all. Obviously, they moved on. It's just not a big deal to them. But I thought she was fascinating. She has a big family in Lebanon and I spent a lot of time with her. She showed me all over Lebanon. So.
And when you talk about bombed out buildings, I'm reminded that probably the most memorable episode of Anthony Bourdain's show was when he was in Lebanon right when the Israeli invasion happened. And at that time, they were really saying that Lebanon was now ready for tourism.
Yeah.
And of course, it got set back a little bit by the things that happened then. But what's your feeling about who is it ready for at this point? Obviously, it's ready for more adventurous tourists like yourself. Is it ready for my parents to go yet? And
it's hard for me to answer because I think anyone can go, of course. But I also know that most people probably wouldn't be comfortable in such a situation. The other thing is, with the unrest around the area and in the Middle East, I would say maybe it's not for everyone right now. Even though it was completely safe while I was there and Lebanon was a good place to be, actually, I think people would be nervous about going, just generally being in that area. But they really have rebuilt. Yet, quite frankly, I always felt like anything could happen at any time. But I also felt like if it's going to happen, it's probably going to happen in certain areas and to kind of stay away from those areas. And you need to, you know some good locals that can keep you up to date and follow the news, the local news, and they can let you know what's going on. And, you know, if you do need to get out or if you don't feel safe, you know, they'll help you out. I don't know. It's a really hard question for me to answer, Chris, because I mean, I was really hesitant. I was hesitant to go at first because there was some unrest there right before I was going. They actually changed over their government and there was a big issue with that. I'm not going to get into all those details because that could take, you know, hours. And I questioned whether I should go. And I was basically in close contact with people like Yola and my host family to try to kind of figure out, is it safe for me to go? And of course, they said, you know, this is normal for Lebanon. Life goes on. Yes, there were some demonstrations up in Tripoli or whatever. And yes, our government just changed over and there are demonstrations a little bit in Beirut. But life goes on. You know, movie theaters are still open, shops are still open, you know, it's safe. And I didn't quite understand, you know, I was still really nervous about going, but once I got there and I was there for a few days, I kind of felt like, okay, I understand what they're saying. And yeah, I felt completely safe. Well, not completely safe. I felt very safe there, though, because they were watching out for me, too.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's go the other way then.
Mm-hmm.
What was the best day you had there? What was the day that made you so glad you didn't chicken out?
You know what? I would say going to Tripoli. I was on a mission while I was there, my own little personal mission. I wanted to photograph souks, and I wanted, you know, old souks, kind of with that Arabic feel, right? And the thing about Beirut, and I told a bunch of people that this is what I want to do. I really
want to
go.
When you say souks, we're talking about markets, just in case anybody doesn't know what we're talking about.
Yes, and specifically, this is one thing I learned, a souk is an outdoor market. At least that's what I was told, because there were certainly souks in Beirut, and there were all these signs about the Beirut souks, and I started following them on my walk, and I showed up, and all it was a super fancy, ultra-modern mall, but it was outdoors, open air kind of thing.
Oh,
and so I went, yeah, I was really disappointed. You know, it was like H&M and Zara, and I was really upset. I'm like, how can they call this a souk? So when I went back to my host family and they asked me what I thought of it, I'm like, well, that's not a souk. And then they explained to me that it was, well, a souk is really any kind of open air market. So I'm like, okay, well, that's fine. Of course, in Beirut, the old souks were destroyed in the war. So they built up new fancy modern ones. So then I was on this mission to try to find older souks. And everyone then told me, oh, go to Byblos. So I hopped in a bus one day and went up to Byblos, which is a little bit north of Beirut, and went into those souks. And yes, they were certainly old souks, but they had been refurbished and had kind of turned into tourist souks. So all it was T-shirts and backgammon sets and lace tablecloths and all that kind of stuff. So that
sort of like
was
the Grand Bazaar in Istanbul at that point.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, and it was definitely for tourists. So I mm-hmm. went back and my host family once again said, what'd you think? And I said, that's not what I was looking for. So it was kind of this fun adventure to try to find what I was looking for. And I tried to explain to them that I went like dirty local souks where locals go to shop. It can be smelly and gross.
Quite possibly the locals like those brand new souks.
I know. That's the problem. Yeah. I'm like, I want to see, you know, goat heads hanging from the markets. And I think it took them a while. They're looking at me like, why would you want to see this? But they understood. And then they sent me up to Tripoli. So that was one of my favorite days. I went up to Tripoli. I actually had met someone that offered to show me around Tripoli, which was great. So I kind of had a personal guide who actually grew up in Tripoli. And sure enough, we got to the old souks, and I just felt like I had a permanent smile on my face because as I walked through them, it's exactly what I was looking for. They were dark, certainly dirty, winding around in this maze. Lots of old architecture. It was all the locals there. I was certainly, the whole day I was in Tripoli, I was the only foreigner I saw. Well, I was the only foreigner around, at least. I never saw any other foreigners. So that's exactly what I was looking for. And the town itself, Tripoli, even when you get out of the souks, is definitely more gritty, definitely gritty, especially a big contrast from Beirut, which I had been spending a lot of time in. So that's where I found all of my excitement and joy and good photography.
Other side trips that you would recommend?
After I went to Tripoli and liked that so much, then everyone understood what I wanted to see. So they sent me south to a town called Saida. And that's about a good hour south of Beirut. And once you go south, it gets interesting because you get much closer to, obviously, the more war-torn areas where a lot of the fighting went on, too, because you're getting closer to the border, right, to the southern border. And so this was a complete Muslim community in Saida. And went down there, and they had a beautiful corniche and also beautiful souks, old, old souks. But they had been refurbished, but they were still refurbished, but they were for locals. They weren't for tourists. So I loved those souks, too. I would definitely recommend Saida. I did not get to Tyre, which I would have liked to. That was a town yet further south.
Saida, I think that's the old ancient town of Sidon the old Phoenician yes. town city. So we're talking yes. about a very ancient city at this point.
Yes. And I have to say, like I said, they refurbished those souks, those old buildings, wonderfully, keeping the old architecture in place, but just really kind of cleaning it up for the most part. I was really impressed. And their corniche was nice. I will say they have a few issues with garbage in that part of the Mediterranean, but hopefully they're kind of on the way to cleaning that up. But other than that, I mean, they had a castle there.
To be
there.
Fair, the city is 6,000 years old. There's a yeah. chance for that some garbage may have accumulated at this point.
well, what it actually is a little bit south of Saida. That's where they used to dump all their garbage, and it's right on the coast. And it's this huge, like, hill, mountain of garbage. And the beach has eroded so much that now it's the waves are crashing in and taking all that garbage and obviously moving it into the Mediterranean. And they're finding it in Cyprus, and it's all over the beach then in Sidon. But don't let that deter you. I mean, it's not the area where you're going to go lay on the beach, but it's certainly a beautiful old city, like you said, and definitely worth a look. Good food, you know, just really, really nice people. As I walked around the souks there, everyone was handing me things to try, to eat, inviting me for tea. I mean, you're killed with kindness in the Middle East, if you ask me. So.
And you mentioned food. I think when we were in Egypt, I think our tour guide said that he thought the Egyptians had the second best food in the Middle East and that Lebanon had the best.
The food was amazing, yeah, I will say. And for me, I don't know. I mean, I'm still a new traveler. I've only been traveling for about 10 years. And so one of the surprises to me about Lebanon and like Jordan and parts of the Middle East is that what I used to think was completely Greek food, like hummus and tabbouleh and that type of stuff, is really Middle Eastern food, is Lebanese food. Of course, Lebanon says that they are the inventors of tabbouleh and hummus. I have no idea if that's true. I know there's a big debate. But yeah, I mean, the food is great. It's very Mediterranean. I can certainly go on about the details of the food if you want me to.
Well, do you have any places that you would recommend that we try the food? I know you were staying at a homestay, so you probably didn't eat dinner out every night.
Yeah. In fact, I don't think I ever ate dinner out. Very, very rarely. Yeah, I was staying at a home, so that was very different. But because of that, I also had really local food. The neighbors all brought me food every night, typically to try different things because they wanted to make sure that I had everything. I'm telling you, the guest culture, to be a guest in Lebanon is like no other place I've ever been, quite frankly. People are so giving and they expect nothing in return. It's kind of this unwritten rule. And if you're a guest there, I mean, you're held up like in the highest regard. But as far as the food goes, what I would say, like some of the things that stuck out to me that I absolutely loved and I would recommend people to try if they can, there's a bread that they'll see all over called kak. Hmm. They'll see it sold by street vendors. It's basically kind of this ring-shaped, or I called it purse-shaped, handbag-shaped, sesame bread. It's really, really good when you get it warm right out of the brick oven or whatever, or the wood oven, and you just slather some cheese on it and eat it. And it's so good. Also, you've got to try, breakfast food is always menouche. Menouche is a little bit thicker, sweeter bread, not too sweet, but a little bit thicker bread. And they put kind of like a pizza dough, if you do a little bit. They put olive oil on it and then a spice called za'atar. Za'atar is the spice of the Middle East, I would say, which is a combination of thyme, oregano, sesame seeds, sumac. But they sprinkle that on top of the olive oil in the bread, and then they kind of put it in an oven. So it is kind of like a pizza. They fold it in half and give it to you, and that's what they have for breakfast. And sometimes they put something called labneh on it, which is really kind of like a sour cream, which is what I preferred. So labneh and za'atar. And that was a great breakfast. There was also another really weird breakfast that they had there that I was quite fascinated with. It was super sweet, kanafe. Kanafe is actually a sweet pastry, kind of like a cheesecake, but like a cheesecake dipped in sweet syrup, actually. Seriously, it was crazy. But in order to cut the sweetness in Lebanon, they actually serve it for breakfast and they put it in between sesame bread. So it's kind of like, if you can imagine, cheesecake served on a sesame seed bun like a hamburger. I know, it was really, really strange, but very good, very sweet. Need some good coffee with that one. That was interesting. Another really good, different food that I enjoyed was called fettah. Fettah is a dip, kind of like hummus or something like that, but this was actually yogurt, garbanzo beans, butter. It was served in a bowl. The bread was underneath. They put the yogurt, the beans, the butter, and then also some nuts that had been fried up in butter. And it was served kind of slightly warm. That was really good. And then your typical, like, of course, you have to try the tabbouleh. Tabbouleh in Lebanon is amazing. They eat it with lettuce leaves a lot, or bread, and the hummus, and of course the falafel sandwiches, and the shawarma. I had shawarma, I don't know, practically 4 times a week, probably. So all very, very good.
Excellent.
Yeah.
As you look at your pictures, as you've been going through it, I imagine, since you got to Sri Lanka, trying to process your trip there.
Yeah.
And I've always enjoyed your photography, by the way, but what picture stands out as just being emblematic for Lebanon?
It's probably the picture of, there's a building in Beirut, which is kind of the eyesore, but also this kind of monumental memory to the war. And it's the old Holiday Inn building. It stands, I don't know, maybe 25 stories. So it's a tall building, but it's just a skeleton now. But it, the story kind of goes that it was open only, gosh, I want to say a few months before the war, the civil war in the 70s broke out. And it became like this major player in the war, so that whoever had control of the Holiday Inn was kind of in control of the war, was winning the war, was kind of the thing.
Well, it was the high ground, as I recall.
Yeah. I mean, it was in the middle of the Green Line, all the fighting. So, and the reason why I find it, it was probably one of my favorite kind of iconic pictures, even though everyone can take that picture. It wasn't anything special in that sense. But, you know, here in the midst of these, all these new condos and this beach skyline, the corniche and the skyline and everything, here stands this like monumental memory of the war, and they can't do anything with it. They can't tear it down. There's all these different reasons why. And you'll learn about that. When I took the Walk Beirut tour, you learn a ton about it, which was really useful to me. And you can walk by it and take pictures and so on. But I just think its placement, where it is, its memory. And every time I was with a local driving by it, it never failed that the local, whoever it may be, would start telling me stories about their memories of it, which I thought was really interesting. Like Yola, my friend, her and her husband, I think it was, they either got engaged there or something on the top floor. There was a revolving restaurant there at one point, kind of thing, you know. So everyone had a story and about it, which I found really interesting. And that's why it was probably one of my favorite photos or favorite things to photograph.
Okay. We talk about this being one of your first trips to Middle East, or I think your first trip to Middle East. When did you feel closest to home, and when did you feel furthest from home?
Closest to home, in some ways, it was in Beirut at times, maybe like more at night when you were going out or something, but it reminded me of New York in many ways. I mean, like I said, it's a very vibrant urban city. And what I would say is, in this way, it reminded me of New York. Everyone's very concerned about what they wear, what they drive. It's very, I'm going to use the word, and this is just my word, probably, it's very pretentious. There's a whole super pretentious side to it. Everyone has to have the latest phone, the latest, you know, but I hadn't been in a culture like that outside of New York or outside of the U.S. for a while, it seemed like. It just was a really strong feeling. I mean, everywhere is Mercedes and BMWs and so on. So that made me feel a little too close to home, quite frankly. When did I feel furthest away? Certainly always the souks do that to me, because we have nothing like it at home, right? You know, you don't walk around and see a camel head hanging. But I would also say, really, also in Beirut, when you'd walk around and you'd see these destroyed buildings and the bullet holes in the buildings, that just, you know, buildings that people lived in today without a problem, but they still just had these scars. And in conjunction with that, as you drove around or walked around, this was the first country I was in that there was always a constant military presence. So there would be Lebanese army there with big guns and tanks and stuff that would just be on the street corners, or certainly if there happened to be some sort of government official living anywhere within that area, there would be military around. So that was very different for me, and I certainly felt far away from home then.
Anything else you would like people to know before they book their ticket to Beirut and Lebanon?
Well, it's funny because I was just thinking, like, I'm afraid I've talked a lot about the war and the history, and I hope that doesn't scare people off, for one thing. For me, I mean, I think you know I'm a very cultural travel person, so I may not go see all the sites, but I really dig into the culture, so I've kind of focused on talking about that. But I would want people to know that there's a very, like, typical touristic side to it, too. So it's one of the best countries to see ruins, Roman ruins, ruins of, from all kinds of decades, actually. So there's a lot of ruin sites that you can go see if you're a ruin person. There's a beautiful hiking that I want to go back to Lebanon. And when I go back to Lebanon, I will go on the hiking trails, without a doubt. There's a whole route, I think, that goes about like 26 days through villages and takes you through the whole of Lebanon called the Lebanon Mountain Trail. So there's hiking, there's big city shopping, there's beach, there's ruins, there's history. So it is a really fascinating place to visit, and you can get all those typical tourist type stuff there too.
Okay. Finish this sentence for me. You really know you're in Lebanon when what?
When you've met someone for just the matter of maybe a short hello conversation or maybe a 5-minute conversation, and they're inviting you into their home. Or into their home or to their city or giving you something. I say that because, as I mentioned earlier, the guest culture there is just over the top. You don't have to know anyone very well or very long at all. And you will have people ensuring that you have an amazing time, buying you things, making sure you try all the famous sweets or the food, or making sure you see everything that's important. It's just over the top. And you don't have to know anyone very long at all. I mean, there were people that I met for a matter of a few minutes in a souk where they're inviting me in their home, having tea. Or there are people that I met through, like, friends of friends that are taking me and showing me the city of Tripoli for a whole day and buying my bus ticket to get there and back. I mean, like, stuff like that that just is not at all what you would expect, but extremely typical for Lebanon and the guest culture there.
Excellent. And if you had to summarize Lebanon in 3 words, what 3 words would you use?
Generous.
Mm-hmm.
I know there's probably a better word, but one of the words that come to mind is confusing. Kind of that idea of contrast, right? So it's a very confusing place. The third word, exuberant, probably. And I say exuberant because it's just really this idea of full of life. There's an attitude there that you're always told is, you know, you have to live for today. And, you know, I know we throw that around a lot in our lives, like, oh, live for today. But they really, like, I've never been to a place where it feels like they mean it more. And it's because of all this uncertainty that they have grown up in and lived with all their lives. And so you don't wait for things ever. In fact, I got chastised once by a friend I went out with. And the next day, he's like, why didn't you take any pictures? We went out for coffee at a coffee or a shisha bar or whatever and had food and drinks. And he's like, why didn't you take any pictures? And I said, oh, well, you know, I was just kind of trying to understand the lay of the land and, you know, scope it out first before I took any pictures. And I said, I'm sure that I'll go back and I'll have another opportunity like this. And he looked at me and he's like, I'm disappointed. He's like, you have to take every opportunity and seize it because you don't know if you're going to have those opportunities again. And that just really struck me. But it is very much how everyone lives their life there. So they live it with a lot of energy and exuberance.
Interesting. And for those of you who don't read regularly on Ott's World, when Sherry talks about getting close to the culture, I'm reminded of a series you did on the motorcycle diaries and learning to learning to ride a motorcycle in Vietnam. So
yeah.
Where can people learn more about what you're doing these days, which I know is quite a lot?
Yes. Well, certainly they can keep up with my travels, at least, on Ott's World. But also, there's a couple other pieces to me, which one is, I think you know, that myself and another partner are trying to really encourage more Americans to do extended travel and take career breaks, and the value of those career breaks to really kind of re-energize and, you know, get out and see the world. Anyway, so that website is called briefcasetobackpack.com. That's full of, like, inspirational stories of many, many Americans, mid-career Americans who have taken off for a year or maybe even 3 months or a year on sabbatical to travel the world. volunteer or whatever. So there's that. That's a great place to follow. If you at all have a desire or you think, you know, you would like to travel the world one day, start reading that because that's kind of interesting. And then the other place where you can find me is we have another website called Meet Plan Go. And we hold a national event where we talk about extended travel and career breaks, and you can network with people in your city. So we're going to be in 18 cities this year on October 18th. We'll have panel presentations. Chris, I know you were involved in the one in San Francisco last year.
I was. Great fun.
Yeah. So we'll have some more experts like yourself in each of these 18 cities on October 18th, and it's a chance for you to kind of come out and learn more about extended travel, career break travel, and a chance to meet other travelers in the area and start to kind of network.
Or want to be travelers.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and that's the thing is, you know, lots of times it's great to help build an actual support structure, really, kind of for sometimes when you want to do something out of the ordinary like this, it's good to surround yourself with some support. And that's kind of what these events do, these in-person events. So that's the other thing I'm working on. So all of those things keep me very, very busy. But I'm always out traveling somewhere. So I'll be lots of places over this next year.
Not least of which, driving a car across Asia.
Yes, across two continents. That's the other thing I'm doing this summer. How could I forget? I'm doing the Mongol Rally. That's my big adventure this summer. It's a charity rally where myself and three other travel bloggers are going to be driving from London to Ulaanbaatar, Mongolia. And we think it's going to take us about 6 to 8 weeks. And we'll be live blogging about it the whole way. It's going to be a huge adventure. We're raising money for a charity, for the Christina Noble Foundation, which supports orphanages in Mongolia. And then also at the end of the rally, hopefully when we make it, inshallah, we actually donate the car that we drove to Mongolia, and then it gets redistributed in Mongolia.
Now, personally, I'm thinking that three travel bloggers and a mechanic might have been a better mix, but we wish you well with that. Sherry, thanks so much for coming back on The Amateur Traveler.
Thank you so much, Chris. This has been fabulous.
I'm going to skip the community news this time, some of the feedback that I've gotten. I'll do that next time, but this show is coming out a little later. But I did want to tell you something interesting that's happening in the Facebook community for The Amateur Traveler, which is facebook.com/amateurtraveler. I've had a lot of people who pitch me travel books or travel apps, and just so much that I don't have time to review them all. So what I'm doing is, for people who are willing to write a review of the app or the book for The Amateur Traveler, I'm sending free apps and free books. So if you're interested in taking part of that, go to the Facebook community at facebook.com/amateurtraveler and join in that conversation. With that, we're going to bring this episode of The Amateur Traveler to a close. If you have questions, feel free to send an email to host@amateurtraveler.com, or better yet, comment on this episode at amateurtraveler.com. You can also follow me on Twitter at Chris2X. And as always, thanks so much for listening. I got to see one more cathedral. I got to sit in one more cafe. I know that I should be